Ditch August Felcher Road Hig Podcreely Bite Size Irish. Hello and welcome to the Bite Size Irish podcast. It's my Shaniel O'Sheal. Meanwhile, Tatan, it's March, and that means it's Shachtan the Gaelic. But every week, really, is Shachtan the Gaelic with Bite Size Irish. As you no doubt already know, learning and speaking a language informs how we see ourselves and the world. And for Irish speakers, it's always intriguing to hear the stories of some of our nearest neighbours. Welsh is, of course, another Celtic language. Breatnach, we call it. Although we in Ireland don't necessarily know a lot about Welsh language and culture. Here today, then, is a conversation about some aspects of Welsh and shared Celtic culture, especially the mythology. And if you'd like to connect with Ireland's mythological tradition, why not become a member of Bite Size Irish? Even better, we have a special discount for podcast listeners. Get 10% off monthly or annual membership of Bite Size Irish, where you'll have access to our self-study courses, our online community and our live calls such as Bio and Cuggermugger. There's no long-term contract and we have a 30-day money-back guarantee. So, just go to offer.irish to sign up now. That's offer.irish to get our exclusive podcast listeners discount. But in the meantime, let's listen to Owen and Gwilym discussing Welsh and Irish mythology.
Do you agree, Bacarda? It's Misha Owen. I'm Owen from Bite Size Irish. And today I've got a very special guest, Dr. Gwilym Morris Baird. Gwilym, Faltistach, welcome in. How are you?
Diolch fawr iawn. Thank you very much. I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
Tommy Arouser Pod. I'm very well. We're joined by a Welsh person today, and there's very interesting strands here between the ancientness of the Irish language, the connection to Welsh, and this gives us a wider perspective coming from Bite Size Irish than, you know, only the Irish language. Gwilym, I invited you today because I've been very interested in your work surrounding Celtic myth. So this, I was telling you before we hit record that I wasn't very familiar with the concept of myth, even. Like, I would have heard of Greek myth. But what is myth? And maybe you can give a little bit of background to yourself as well, who you are, how you've come to this point of looking at myth.
Okay. I mean, how long have you got? It's quite a big story, that one, but I'll try and condense it down. Having been born and raised in a Welsh-speaking family and, you know, doing all of my education through to university, through the medium of Welsh, you know, I've always had a fascination for my own traditional culture, Welsh culture, Welsh music and Welsh literature, ancient Welsh literature, you know, old Welsh myths, old Welsh stories. And it just grew from there, really. I've always had been inspired by and drawn to my own tradition, if you like. And then through that, through Welsh culture, through into the broader Celtic culture. So, you know, I've also progressed into the study of Celtic myth, and that includes the medieval Irish stories that preserve myths, and also different bits of folklore from Scotland and Ireland and Cornwall and the Isle of Man and Brittany, all of the Celtic lands, really. So that's my main focus today, is researching and writing about and teaching about the Celtic traditions of the past. And Celtic myth is a catch-all term that essentially includes lots of different types of literature. It does include what we might call types of oral literature, but even when we're looking at oral literature, as in stories that were recorded as being told or performed, they're still written down. So in essence, we're looking at lots of written works, basically. But definitely in terms of what we'd call traditional myth, and you know, the traditional idea of a myth is an old story that usually corresponds to some type of belief about the world, usually about the supernatural realm. So myths often talk about gods and goddesses or supernatural beings or spirits of different types. The other world is a, you know, a prominent idea in Celtic myth in general. But, you know, there's also the perhaps the slightly more updated understanding of what a myth is. And that is really any story, narrative, or piece of art, let's say, in a simple sense, that expresses beliefs about the world. Perhaps things that we take for granted about how the world is and why the world is the way it is. So not just stories to entertain, but stories that explain things about why we live the way we do and why things are the way they are, I suppose. That's the very, very simple, reduced version of what a myth is. We could go on for like another 3 weeks, I reckon, but that's a good start, let's say.
Wow, that's a profound answer, Gwynham. So you spoke about how they're written down stories. So how old do these writings go of these stories? And do you think I hope it's okay to call them stories. Are these stories much older than what was written down, do you think?
So that is the crucial question. And the general assumption is yes. So in, you know, Ireland has a much broader collection of medieval manuscripts. There's a lot more that was preserved in Ireland than there was in Wales, but there's still a substantial collection of medieval texts in Wales too. But for example, in Ireland, some of the oldest stories that we study were first written down in the 7th or 8th centuries. In Wales, probably a few hundred years after that. But these medieval manuscripts, these written down texts, are like snapshots of broader oral culture, where there would have been many more versions of these types of stories told. You know, storytellers would have sat down in front of families, communities, royal courts, you know, different groups of people, and told these stories orally as a spoken art, if you like. So what we're talking about when we say Celtic myth, we're really referring to written texts, which are themselves just sort of brief snapshots of a slowly evolving and very diverse body of oral narratives that you know, that people told and recounted and had been doing so for, well, since there was even the whole notion of there being Celts. People have been telling stories since they were people, yeah? So storytelling is older than the whole idea of Celtic culture. And that ancient tradition comes into Celtic culture and slowly evolves through the different Celtic languages, which is how we find them.
Mm. Wow. And so in Ireland, we have the concept of the role of the Seanchéí, the person who tells the story. I guess a typical image is by the fire, by the hearth. Would those stories being told in the family and the community, would they be at a different level of formality to the written? Because, for example, I see, say, the Greek myth, they seem much more formal than something like a kid's fairy tale that you might tell at bedtime, right? So there seems to be this kind of range of formality. Would that be the case?
That's definitely the case. And there's two basic types of formality, let's say, or two relationships to the story itself. You've got the storyteller, the Seanchéí, as you say in Ireland, the Cyfarwydd, as we'd say in Welsh. And these traditional roles were really about preserving story, important, significant story, which were often considered to be actual history, what we would call today a pseudo history. So a story of the past, which relates to some, you know, vaguely remembered event in the past. So that's part of storytelling, but also myths. So myths that weren't describing anything real, but they had a great value to the storytellers. So they used these myths because they discussed social norms and values and customs. And as I said before, they gave reasons for things. But these storytellers, they could be professional storytellers, as we find in both Ireland and Wales, who were learned people, scholars, who remembered lineages and histories and medical knowledge and legal knowledge. You know, they preserved a lot of this stuff alongside the stories. And then you had common folk who told stories, you know, old folks who knew loads of stories and old folks who could entertain their families on long winter nights. You know, storytelling was a major part of culture in the past. It still is to this day, but we've exported it into tellies and internets and cinemas and what have you. But in the past, it was still just as important. It came out of the mouth and into the ear. So that's one side of the relationship. Then on the other side of the relationship, you've got the audience themselves. And if you can just imagine that even for a folk tale that sounds like a kid's story, the way a seven-year-old girl hears that story for the first time is going to be very different to how a 70-year-old grandmother hears that story for the first time. So for the child, it is a kid's story. It's exciting. It's got magic and wonder and enchantment and, you know, chase scenes and witches and wizards and warriors and all that good stuff. But for the grandmother, they're going to hear a different message perhaps in that children's story. So even though folk tales or fairy tales can appear childish and childlike, they can also be appreciated from a more mature perspective as also containing myth, yeah, important ideas, important concepts and philosophies, spiritual ideas and philosophies very often. So it's not just how the story is remembered and told by the storyteller. It's also how it's heard by the audience that you know, that's the range of meaning that we have, if you like.
Mm. I find it fascinating. It's this kind of interconnectedness of, so understanding what you said, this explanation of why we are the way we are and why we believe in the way we believe. And probably a strand of that of like how you should behave or believe in our society. There's probably that part of it too. I find it profound, and I'd like to cover it more. We'll jump away from myth a little bit because right now we'll come back. With Bites as Irish, we've got people learning the Irish language worldwide. So the language is an intrinsic part of everything we do. We look at Irish culture, but it's always through the lens of the language. So bringing it back to you, Gwynam, so you mentioned your Welsh background. So you were brought up through the Welsh language, right?
Yes.
Was this, paint a picture of like, was this in a community of Welsh speakers? And I guess a next question that jumps to mind is how it was that then compared to today in the same region?
So my family, my grandparents were born and raised in Mid Wales, in the middle of the country, in a farming community, which was, you know, almost 100% Welsh-speaking, 90% Welsh-speaking, let's say. And then my grandparents moved closer to the Welsh border with England to a market town in the northeast of Wales, where there were far fewer Welsh speakers, but there was still a substantial Welsh-speaking community there. So I think it around that time, it was about maybe 30, 40% of the town was Welsh-speaking and the rest were English-speaking. Many people still consider themselves Welsh, even though they couldn't speak Welsh. And then, of course, lots of people who'd moved into the town from England. So a good mix of people. And then when my mother's and aunt and uncle's generation was going to school, that was the first generation to have Welsh language education, my mother's generation, really. Before that, Welsh language education was banned. You weren't allowed to teach through the medium of Welsh. You could only teach through the medium of English. Of course, there's a long and complex history with England and the English sort of the conquering of Wales by England, which is the background to all of this. And then my generation was perhaps the second or third generation to then go through a Welsh language education system. So my own sort of family was, you know, we were Welsh speakers, but we were Welsh speaking in the family, but I grew up on a street which was mainly English speaking. There weren't many Welsh speakers around where I grew up, although there were definitely some in the area. But the school I went to was Welsh speaking. So you had a lot of Welsh families sending their kids to the Welsh school. And generally people went to English speaking schools, but we had a Welsh school where I went. But also English speaking families sent their kids to the Welsh school so their kids can learn Welsh, because they believed in, you know, reviving the Welsh language, even though they couldn't speak it themselves. So it's quite a complex mix. So my education was, the teachers all spoke English, but because there were lots of kids from English speaking families, the majority of kids were from English speaking families who didn't have much Welsh when they started. I grew up, you know, on the playground, it was the English language that was spoken, but education was in Welsh. So you've got that whole range of relationships to the Welsh language, really. I was fortunate to be raised in a Welsh family and have a Welsh language education, whereas some people only had the Welsh language education. So they grew up speaking Welsh and could speak Welsh, but their culture, if you like, was English.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. You know, I see parallels to myself. I went through Irish language education. I was brought up in an Irish language speaking family. So, you know, we have a common thread there. Mm-hmm. We had English in the playground. Huge majority of the kids were from English speaking families. And their parents wanted their kids to go to the Gaelscoil. And more recently, you know, my kids go to the local Gaelscoil, and there's parents now who attended that same school. So you're starting to get that second generation now, like it's there, where the parents have gone through that education. They probably haven't used Irish language in any formal sense through their adult lives, but they have a foundation, more of a foundation than there ever was when they started, you know, a generation ago. So it's this slowly evolving change, but it is each generation it gets stronger in some sense. I don't know what the future looks like, but it's definitely what Irish language education has reached here. And just to be clear to people watching, like, a big majority of schools in Ireland teach through English, and there's the Irish language is a subject, but it's, you know, we have a whole belief or myth in the society that I think lives on, questioning the validity of the language in someone's daily life, you know, so they don't see that connection maybe. But having said all that, I see a lot of pride in fellow parents in the school. They're more than happy to have their kids speak Irish. Parents try to use some Irish language with their kids. So I think it's become more normalized. And I'm speaking specifically, like, I'm living in Limerick City. So definitely an English language speaking community by tradition. but of course, there's many languages being spoken in Limerick as well. So things change that way too. It's really interesting. So a follow-up question on that. So because I don't have much context on the Welsh scenario. You know, I don't have direct exposure to this world. So what would the mix of schooling be in Wales now? Does it depend on region in Wales of what language the school is teaching in?
So the majority of schools, I think the situation is pretty similar to Ireland, to be honest. The majority of schools will have a bare minimum of Welsh. So Welsh as a subject. And then you have the Welsh stream schools, which are a separate type of education, which teach through the medium of Welsh. And even though there are more English stream schools that teach through the medium of English than there are Welsh schools, the Welsh education system, you know, tries to serve all of the different communities. I'm not going to pretend that it actually succeeds in doing that very often, because there are competing interests, particularly with a large influx of people always moving into Wales from England who might not necessarily understand why we need, you know, they need to teach their kids any Welsh at all, which is often a problem. But, you know, like my kids go to a Welsh-speaking primary school, even though most of the kids going there are English-speaking. So they will at least come away with some Welsh. And, you know, it's not a perfect situation, but my children will be able to receive all of their education through the medium of Welsh and go on to university to study Welsh, you know, or to study other subjects through the medium of Welsh. So you can just about get away with having all of your education through Welsh, basically. Yeah.
Yeah, gotcha. Really interesting. And yeah, interesting to see the common threads there too. So staying with the concept of language, but let's kind of look back a bit. A few thousand years, maybe. Irish and Welsh are related languages, right? What are the current estimates of how did that happen? When did this split, or how did this split happen? Like, what's your sense of this, Gwynnim?
So in Celtic scholarship, this you know, the theories and ideas about what Celtic is and where it comes from have changed over the last few decades. In particular, there's some relatively new work that is quite convincing, I think, and it's the story that I currently prefer, although of course, you know, with new evidence things can always change. So tentatively, as far as we can tell, the best story I found, and the one I agree with most, is that the Celts, all the Celtic-speaking nations, the Celtic peoples are the descendants of the Indo-Europeans, and the Indo-European culture originates on the Russian steppes, effectively, over towards the east, and this is about 6,000 years ago. And then roughly about 5,000 to 4,500 years ago, they start traveling east and west. And one branch turns up in Europe and effectively replaces the earlier, or replaces a majority of the earlier Neolithic culture. And the Neolithic peoples are, you know, those who built Brúna Bóinne and Stonehenge and Bryn Celli Ddu. And lots of the old ancient monuments were built by that Neolithic culture. And those people are pretty much replaced by the incoming Indo-Europeans roughly 4,500 years ago in Western Europe, in the northwest of Europe. And these are the ancestors of the Celts. And over time, that language, whatever language they're speaking, the Proto-Indo-European, evolves into what we might call Proto-Celtic. And, you know, the guess is around 3,000 years ago, the Proto-Celtic that's spoken in present-day Ireland and Britain and northwestern Europe in general starts to split. It starts to divide into what turns into Irish and effectively what turns into Welsh. There's lots of other bits in between, but that's the simplest description of what happens. So fundamentally, that means that the Welsh and the Irish were effectively the same people, or come from the same type of culture, about 3,000 3,500 years ago. So we've evolved differently, of course, and by now we're very distinct. You know, I can speak Welsh and you can speak Irish, and we might hear some similarity with some words, but fundamentally they're very different. So in many ways our traditions and mythologies have also evolved. They're diverse, but at their core, at their roots, just like our language, they're also very similar in some fundamental ways.
The time span is absolutely amazing. And before we start digging into the myth a bit more, that interesting thread, like, help me understand this, because my upbringing was the idea of, you know, the Celts were over in Europe. They were over in mainland Europe, Central Europe, and there was a wave of them or their culture, or I'm not sure what, out, and that arrived. So that wasn't maybe long before the time of Christ. So that's not four and a half thousand years ago. But you're still talking about the Celts. So what's your understanding here? Was the Celtic culture forming in our lands already, and we're not talking about this influx, this import from Central Europe?
So the old story of where the Celts came from is, yeah, essentially they turn up sometime before the Romans and Christianity, and they originate in roughly Central Europe, or sort of the middle of, sort of north of Italy, let's say, roughly speaking, around Germany, Austria, that area. Now, that story was based pretty much on the physical evidence of archaeology, that we saw that there were styles of art and the production of expensive goods like swords and metalwork. Yeah, and these styles begin roughly, 2,600 years ago, 700 years ago. And those styles, which go through a Hallstatt and a Latène period, is in the technical parlance, based on the places where many of these finds were made, these styles clearly then influence art styles in Britain and elsewhere. And based on the sort of the spread of those art styles, we base our earlier story of where the Celts came from and where they went. But there appears to be another story that we can tell, which is based on DNA and on linguistics. So looking at how different names are, what types of names are recorded where and how they're spread across Europe, and also the DNA of current living populations and how they relate to other populations elsewhere in the world. I would say that it's far more likely, and there's various Celtic scholars and historians now that argue quite persuasively for this, that even though there's definitely a change in culture and a cultural influence that begins in Central Europe, which is the old story of where the Celts come from, it's far more likely that that was just one phenomena within a pre-existing Celtic culture, which actually included what we might call the Western seaboard of Europe. So, you know, Spain, France, Ireland, Wales, Scotland. And this also maps onto, how Indo-European DNA turns up in Europe about 4,500 years ago. And it kind of agrees with the story that historical linguistics tells us too. So I know I've kind of butchered that story in trying to summarize it, and there's probably historians and archaeologists and linguists throwing their slippers at the internet now, but I think that's the simplest story I can give.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Yeah, and to back that up, like, there is no one story. I mean, it's not black and white. We're not telling the story of what happened from one day to the next. You can't. So it's trying to interpret the different strands of evidence and to try to see what theories hold up. Mm-hmm. Yeah, between linguistics, archaeology, and it seems more recently the ancient DNA techniques that can tell a different story. So this is fascinating because when I'm reading, like, I've been reading and watching a lot about this recently, and it's not an understanding I had grasped, the story that you are telling. So to realize for me, this is a personal realization that, okay, the Irish language, Welsh, could have been and may well have been like, it's the direct, I don't want to say descendant, but like there's, it's been evolving in these lands for much longer than what I had understood it to be.
For certain.
Which, yeah, it's like I've visited Bruna Boina for the first time this year that you mentioned, and there's always the question for me of like, you know, who were these people? Just trying to imagine what it was. And from what I understand, you mentioned the Neolithic people. There were an earlier wave of people, not who we would call the Indo-Europeans. So a different set of people were living, and they were organized, say, in Ireland, well before that. So it's just my imagination runs wild, and it's, I guess, maybe trying to tell that story, and it comes all the way to today going, well, what are we speaking? What is this language? So you mentioned this commonality we have across the Atlantic seaboard of Europe today. So to bring us to myth, so maybe to bring it home to Wales for you, what's the, this is a very broad question, what's the nature of myth in Wales? What do the typical stories cover? From about when, again, were these written down?
Okay. So, again, to summarize as best I can, the most important stories we have were first written down about 900 years ago. But again, we can think of them as written versions, snapshots of a broader oral culture where there are many different variations of these types of story. But we can read in these written texts older ideas, more ancient ideas, older types of myth that would have existed 1500 years ago, perhaps 2000 years ago, maybe even older. And one of the ways that we can guess at the age of some of these myths is by comparing them with stories from other places and seeing what's comparable. You know, it's called comparative mythology. We compare myths from two different but related traditions or cultures and then guess at when those myths might have diverged or how they've influenced each other to try and understand what their history is, basically. As far as what types of stories these are, well, I think we could generally call them wonder tales. They often feature magic and the other world, kings and queens who can almost be read as types of deities or types of gods. I mean, the whole concept of a god or goddess in the past is quite problematic. That we would have to unpick a little to understand it properly. You know, divinity or deity is something very different in the Celtic tradition to how we might think of it today. And there are also stories about animal transformation and about magic, but also they are stories that tend to show more than they tell. So they show or illustrate ideas more than simply state what the idea is. So, for example, they illustrate different types of time. So the other world is often described as a place where there is a different type of time. Or, you know, people can, in Welsh folklore, for example, you know, shepherds up in the hills will come across the fair folk, the Tylwyth Teg, And the fair folk, he'll be dancing with the fair folk, and he'll think he's just been there for one night, but it turns out he's been dancing for 100 years, and he goes home and nobody recognizes him. Yeah? So this idea that there is a different type of time in the other world is a common feature of both Welsh and Irish stories, actually. But we could say that it's showing, it's illustrating a philosophy where there is our time, the time of the mortals, and then there is divine time or sacred time, the mythic time, which is different. So this is an illustration of a belief in two different realms, yeah? The realm of the mortals and the realm of the immortals, let's say. Even though the text doesn't specifically say this is a philosophy which describes the realm of mortals, the realm of immortals, we can read in the story an illustration of that idea. Yeah. So that's the kind of work I do in both Welsh and Irish myth. Yeah, that type of interpretation.
And on that divine time, that other time, like, what can that tell us, or what's it helping us understand?
Well, I think in a very simple sense, it comes from the ancient perspective on the cosmos, on how time comes about, where time comes from, and what's our relationship as human beings to our very limited perspective on time. So going back to Bruna Boyna, for example, Newgrange, you know, which is a passage tomb, and at winter solstice, the sun shines down the passage and lights up the inner chamber. So the Neolithic culture that precedes the Indo-Europeans, they had a sense of sacred time at winter solstice when the sun is at its lowest in the sky. And at winter solstice, the sun appears to sort of stay relatively still for a period of 4 or 5 or 6 days. It doesn't appear to move much where it rises and sets, yeah? So it's evoking this idea of there's like a stillness in time. So clearly, when the Indo-Europeans turn up, they, even though they tend to replace the early Neolithic culture, they're also receiving lots of these different influences. They probably also had their own native understanding of cosmic time, time that's pertinent to the sun and the moon and the stars, and perhaps even the idea that it's the sun or the moon that creates time, that these astronomical events like the winter solstice and the summer solstice and the equinoxes, these are proof that time is created by the movement of the planets and the stars and the moon. So from that sense, you have a greater cosmic time, which is different to personal time. Yeah, it's different to the time that we experience. And of course, we can see how this would lead on to ideas of a supernatural time, a greater time, a mythic divine time, which is beyond our understanding, but which we glimpse at these important moments when the winter solstice sun shines down the passage at Bruna Boyna. So it illustrates a perspective, yeah, on how people saw the universe and that they lived in the past. I would say that's one way of interpreting what some of these stories might mean.
And isn't that the same sense of wonder in a way that gets us to imagine, you know, 5,000 years ago, imagining the peoples building these monuments, imagining what it was like inside, and it brings us back to a very different timeline than, oh, I have to get my breakfast and I have to pack my kids to school. It's a completely different sense of time. And for me, I don't know about you, when I visit places like this, I can feel that. I can tune in to some kind of sense of that. There's a hill fort, Mucan Hill Fort, in County Clare, so it's not too far from me. It's not that old. I think something like 600 or 900 BC it would have been started, but there were layers of development there. It's a hill fort. There's three peripheral walls, which I think are the oldest part of it, and then there's newer, smaller caches of stone. So they used the stone of the outer rings to build these more kind of more fortified enclosures, which they would have, I think, lived in, say, with their animals as well. So there's a whole story of a long evolution just in that site. And when I visit there, something I can just calm down a little and tune in to that time a bit. And definitely visiting Bruna Boina and walking through that passage, going, this, seeing a rock art of a fern, this intricate, what I would call otherwise a painting, but it's into the stone, etched. Just absolutely amazing. Do you get that sense when you visit these special places?
Absolutely. I mean, my just to let you into a little secret, I'm actually a musician before I'm anything else. So I generally think of myself as an artist before I'm a researcher and a teacher. And a lot of my inspiration is taken from this greater sense of time that you were alluding to there, this sense that there is a much greater, far older, vaster story going on around us. All that goes on right now. And that gives me a sense of perspective on my own life, if you like. I also get it when I'm up in the mountains. You know, the mountains stand for a similar idea, antiquity, ancient time. And these places are so old, they appear to have fostered their own types of personality. A place has a personality, an identity, a character. And, you know, creatively and spiritually, this is something that I'm often drawn to, if you like. I find it intriguing and very, very inspiring, basically.
And then on that strand of you being a musician and bringing us to, you know, that modern idea of flow, it's like there's a timelessness in the now of just creating your art or your music or being in the music. Isn't that right too?
Absolutely, yeah. So the great magic of performance, you know, when it's going really well, I'm sure you've experienced this, most musicians will know that, you know, particularly in a session or something, and you know, the beer is flowing and everybody's in high spirits, everybody's really immersed in the music, where there is nothing but the music. That's all there is. There is the presence of you know, harmony and pattern making and rhythm, and then it's as if the self dissolves in that, or you're not as important. There appears to be a sense of us all coming together in the music, you know. So absolutely, this very magical, enchanting ability of the arts, not just music, but all types of arts, to do that for us, to provide us with that sense of beyond the self, you know, what is outside of us, that we're no longer just this restricted identity, we're part of something greater, perhaps. I don't know what it is. I mean, part of me doesn't really care what it is. So long as I can keep going there, I'm fine, you know.
Yeah, like I said, like to you, I have to remind myself, hey, Owen, don't get too serious about this. Like, you know, yeah. We're here to play and to have fun. Like, if we're not doing that, why are we here? You know.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I'm wondering, so we've got the Tírnanog story in Ireland. They go to Tírnanog and you stay young until you come back, and you age very quickly. Is there a similar land in Welsh myth where people go to?
Yeah, and there is indeed. I'm going to just pause momentarily because I'm about to get lots of really strong sunshine and it's going to bleed out my camera. Just hopefully that doesn't make too much of a difference in your edit. But anyway, so Tírnanog, the Irish idea, you know, which is often an otherworldly island far out to sea. It's sometimes the Isle of the Blessed or the Island of Women. I'm literally just teaching a course now on the voyage of Bran, Imrov Bran, which is one of the Irish stories, you know, about this, a journey to the other world. in the Welsh tradition, we have something that's very similar called Caer Siddhi, the fortress of the other world. And that Welsh name Siddhi is actually borrowed from the Irish she. And of course, you know, in old Irish, it could have been something more like sheath. The DH may have been pronounced, as far as we know, and then gives the Welsh Siddhi. So Welsh storytellers and bards were clearly aware of the Irish concept and thought, oh, yeah, that's what we're talking about, too. So they borrowed the Irish name for it. In the Welsh tradition, Caer Siddhi is the place where the immortal souls reside. Sickness and old age do not affect us. It's pretty much identical to the idea of Tir na n-Og, the land of youth, the land of the ever youthful. And again, this corresponds to the timeless realm, this different greater cosmic time, where there appears to be perpetual abundance and where mortality is not a problem. And, you know, we've got different religious influences affecting how that idea evolves. So in Ireland and Wales, there was clearly an idea of this other world before Christianity turns up. And then when Christianity turns up, it influences this idea. And over time, the native pagan Irish and Welsh of the world appear to conform more to the Christian idea of paradise or heaven or the state of humanity before the fall, if you like, before Adam and Eve were kicked out of Eden. All of these ideas, these myths are kind of, they mix together, particularly in medieval literatures in Ireland and Wales, especially in Ireland. I mean, we see it most clearly in stories like Imre of Bran, you know, The Voyage of Bran, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
I could bang on, yeah, I could go on for a while about this. So, you know, stop me when you've had enough.
Oh, fantastic. You have a recent video about Danu and Dan, and to be honest, I don't have much context on either, but you told the story of how this maybe relates, you know, back much more east as well, and there's some hypotheses about the same kind of etymology of these words being seen in Europe. So if you don't mind, what are these myths? So what's a brief summary of these myths, Irish and Welsh myth?
So there appear to be two very similar characters in Welsh and Irish myth, and we find other similar characters. So, you know, there's Lu in Ireland, there's Llei in Wales, there's Mananon in Ireland, there's Manawydan in Wales. There are similarly named characters, although their stories are quite different. But there are also common themes between Welsh myth and Irish myth. So we know that there's a connection somewhere between the two. So when we come to look at the Welsh character Dawn, who is a mysterious character in Welsh myth. She's the mother of other characters. We only know of her because she is described as the mother of Arianrhod and Gwydion in particular from the fourth branch of the Mabinogi. So she's this ancient ancestress who appears to be the mother of what could have one time been a family of gods, perhaps. We're not sure. They appear to look like medieval versions of earlier gods, at least. And Dawn, therefore, is like the great ancestral deity. And then over in Ireland, we have Danu, whose name doesn't appear anywhere in Irish literature, but we can derive the name Danu from the term Tuatha De Danann. The people of the goddess Danu, effectively, is what Tuatha De Danann means. And the Tuatha De Danann are, of course, the ancient tribe of Irish immortals, or perhaps we can even call them gods. Again, I think we've got to be careful with the term gods sometimes, or deity, because we're kind of talking about a different type of being in the Celtic tradition to what we normally think of as a deity. But, you know, that's another rabbit hole that we could get lost down. So we've got the Tuatha De Danann, the children of the goddess Danu, or the people of the goddess Danu, and the children of Dawn, the children of this great ancestress in Welsh tradition. And both of these figures, these ancient mother figures, are mysterious. We don't know much about them, but they appear to be mothers of pantheons, of tribes of gods or immortals. And so this led people to assume, well, maybe this is one of those examples where the Irish and the Welsh traditions have preserved their evolved variations of an older original myth of an ancestress, a great ancestor goddess. And this could still be the case, but then over the last 100 years, Celtic scholars and historical linguists have been on the case trying to figure out, well, where do these different names come from? Does Dawn, which sounds like Danu, you know, we're only a few vowels off there, are these names that have evolved from an original older proto-Celtic name, perhaps? And that certainly was one theory. But over time, linguists have argued for different meanings to this name, basically. So Tua de Donan could relate to an older Celtic idea, Danu being a name of a river goddess, perhaps, coming from an ancient Indo-European word for flow or water or liquidness or flowingness. Dawn, on the other hand, could come from the same roots, but it could also mean something like earth or place or people of a place. So there's all these different meanings that we find in the histories of these words, and linguists have basically been trying to explain the origins of these words, of these names, and what therefore these meanings tell us about these potential goddesses. And it's an intriguing and fascinating sort of exploration of deep history, of where these names come from and what do they mean. One of the more intriguing stories perhaps is that, you know, Danu is the name of potentially a goddess in Irish culture, but she's also the name of a river goddess in Vedic culture over in northern India. And of course, the Sanskrit language, the Sanskrit culture, the Vedic culture, is a cousin to the Celtic culture. They're another branch of the Indo-European family of languages that evolved separately, but in northern India, whereas their cousins traveled west to Ireland and northwestern Europe. So there's a whole range of complex reasons that we can give for what these names mean, and there's no real agreement on what they are, but it's just fascinating to dig into this rich history because it gives us a sense of these great epochs of time once again and how ancient and how old our traditions are.
Yeah. It's interesting. I suppose the thing that jumps out for me is, well, we have these archetypes, like to bring in Jungian psychology, the archetypes of the great mother. And this might have been a sense that people had without necessarily having the same shared story, right? It's like a human sense that emerged, it happened to emerge in different places. What do you think about that?
So, I mean, Jungian archetypes and the whole idea of a collective unconscious, these are fascinating modern ideas that really can help us understand the story of the past, for sure. I think the major difference, though, is that Jungian psychoanalysis and Freudian psychoanalysis, they're really seeking to explain an internal reality, something that goes on inside of us. And, you know, Jung may have taken this a step further and said, well, there is perhaps a psychic reality that we're all attuned to. But I think that description of myth is relatively modern. And although it's useful and it helps us, it's not the same as how people in the past thought about these things. I think in the past, people didn't necessarily think of an internal life or an internal symbolic reality. They thought of these things as outside of them in the world, in the greater world. And the further you go out into the greater world, the further, you know, that you can cross the seas and arrive at these magical islands. It's all external. People lived inside the world of myth, as opposed to the world of myth living inside of us. So I think, even though, you know, I find Jung fascinating and his description of the human psyche absolutely fascinating and useful, I think when I'm teaching, I always try and stress that it's important to try and separate them also. That we can, it's a useful description, but it's not the description that people had in the past, I would say. I would say it was much different. It was the other way around. One thing that archetypes do give us, though, is the idea that there are common themes that all humanity are drawn to. And of course, as you know, the human animal is the same shape all across the world. We all arrive in the world in the same way. We've all got mothers. Yeah, we may not know who our fathers are, but we've definitely also got fathers. We've also got teachers. We've also got different types of relationships. And all of these basic human experiences, I think they do feed into myth. They feed into common ideas in myth. Again, we've got to be careful because different cultures approach these ideas differently, but they are fundamentally the same ideas, I would say. By today, we have to be careful of not making too many assumptions about other people's cultures. I think we've got to be a bit more sensitive to how other cultures are internally coherent, and that's something that we can't always understand ourselves. But yeah, there's still basic human experiences that we share with all of humanity. You know, I'm a universalist at heart. I think everybody, all humans have common experiences for sure. And the archetypes are proof of that. Yeah.
Thanks for delving into that. And you mentioned the deities, so please help us understand what is a Celtic deity and how might it be different to what I might be assuming when I hear that word?
So we have to, you know, we've lived and our culture has evolved through Christianity for at least the last 1500 years. So Christianity first gets to Ireland and Wales, you know, roughly 1500 years ago, let's say. And then over the following centuries, Christianity becomes the dominant worldview. And the Christian God is very much in heaven and apart from humanity. And it's Jesus who comes to bring the presence of that Christian God to humanity, yeah? We also have what we might call the classical notion of deity, of gods and goddesses, so Greek gods or Roman gods and goddesses, who again can sometimes walk among us as in the shape of humans, but they're very much human beings writ large, yeah? But they're still on a pedestal. They're still perfect and separate, and you have a devotional relationship to them. I think in Celtic culture, we see those influences and there are similar ideas. But when we actually come to look at what we could call gods or goddesses in Celtic myth, they're not as separate to humanity as the Christian god or the classical gods and goddesses are. In many ways, there appears to be a race of immortals who are human-like and can come and live on the mortal plane and even intermarry with mortals and have children with them and be sort of part of the broader community and society, yet they originate in this immortal time, in this timeless other world. They also look very much like the aristocracy. They look like kings and queens. They look like people of power and authority who held dominion over the rest of humanity. They're also sometimes people who reincarnate time and time again. So, you know, Cuchulainn in the Irish tradition can be read as the reincarnation of Lu. Taliesin reincarnates time and time again. in the Welsh tradition. These different characters who appear to have immortal souls, but come and go from the timeless realm. They arrive in the mortal realm and then they go back and then they come back in this sort of cyclic motion of reincarnation. So when we're talking about gods and goddesses, there's definitely similarities with the classical tradition and even a little bit with the Christian notion of a god as something separate, powerful, which determines, you know, the fates of all living beings and is the source of all life and so on and so on. There's definite similarities, but the way that these deities appear in Celtic myths is different. It's definitely different.
There's different things coming up for me. It's very interesting. It's intriguing. It feels, the sense I'm getting from your explanation, and I'm sorry if I've gotten it wrong, like the Christian God, you know, is everywhere. Whereas these gods, were they less omnipresent and they're more like a divine being?
Yeah, and in Irish culture in particular, you see that these gods, these immortals, are located in specific places. They belong to specific she mounds, yeah? So they're very regional in that sense. They're very much in one place. You know, the Macoke or the Dagda associated with Brúna Boina, for example, or Enya, you know, the river goddess of the Boyne, the Bowen. That's, you know, the palace of the Boyne is where they live, if you like. So even though the Dagda, for example, has these great cosmic powers of being able to change time and, you know, perform these great acts of strength and creates these big earthworks and has these sacred, you know, symbolic objects, the cauldron, the harp and the club. So they look like gods in that sense, but they're also, yeah, they're very localized also. They appear to exist on this whole spectrum where they can be gods in the full sense, but they're also very close to being humans also, I suppose.
Okay, but hold on a second. Is this just the aristocracy portraying themselves as gods in those cultures?
Don't tell everybody. So yes and no. Yes and no. I often try and describe how myths come about as we have common culture. And I would say that in the past, the common culture of the Celts, wherever we were, was that we believed in reincarnation. We believed that the soul would come back sometimes as animals, sometimes as humans, yeah? And then within the middle of that common culture, you've got the aristocracy who control all the resources and who can pay storytellers to do stuff. And therefore, you can see how the aristocracy would take these common ideas and then try and monopolize them for their own ends and say, well, no, actually, we're the only special ones. So we're the only ones who really get to reincarnate. So you common folk, it doesn't happen for you anymore. It's just for us, just for us special people. And thereby, you get this idea of the Celtic gods really as, yeah, the aristocracy writ large. I mean, this is something that Mark Williams talks about in his recent book, Ireland's Immortals, that everything about the Celtic gods looks like just a cartoon version of the aristocracy, basically. And, you know, that's always going to be the case because they controlled the resources. They had a massive impact on culture. But that doesn't mean that these myths and these beliefs didn't have other versions or other stories that existed in common culture also. Yeah, that's the distinction I'd like to make. Yeah. If that helps at all, I don't know. Maybe it just makes it more complicated. I don't know.
Well, it is all complicated.
It's very nuanced. Yeah.
So, stretching back a bit to what you were describing, the divine time and that we're all part of this divine time, I think that's one lens to look at this. It gets us, the people hearing the stories now or then, to kind of realize, hey, there's something bigger, there's something longer term than the here and the now. Although, like we said, again, the here and the now is eternal in its own way as well. So I find that intriguing. Do you think, this is maybe going too philosophical, do you think in Celtic culture, did people feel that they were part of the gods, or was there, do you think, the sense of, I'm human, but I do, I'm sitting in this much greater dance around me? Do you get my question?
I do, yeah. So to come back to this idea of the gods as the aristocracy writ large, my own interpretation of that, and it's very difficult to prove because we don't really have enough evidence, but the best way I can explain that is that you would have had mortal noblemen and noble women who saw themselves as embodiments of these divine realities. So, for example, you know, a common figure in Irish myth and Celtic myth in general is the sovereignty goddess, the divine sacred woman who is an embodiment of the land and the territory and the abundance of the land and all of that good stuff. And I'm guessing that there would have been actual mortal women in the past who believed that they were that divinity made manifest, incarnate on the mortal plane. And we can see how this feeds into the whole idea of, you know, the god kings and, you know, the idea that aristocracy is divine in some way, touched by God or God's representatives. And we see this in the Christian tradition also, you know, that it's the king in many ways is a mortal representation of the greater divine reality. Yeah. Beyond that, so if we now try and account for the influence of aristocracy and not negate it necessarily, but try and think of this concept outside of aristocracy and amongst common folk, well, we can see that there are also folk tales about, you know, special women, particularly in Wales, who are fairy women who appear out of lakes and marry the local farmer, and that she brings abundance and prosperity to the farmer. So instead of her needing to be the queen, she's just an expression of the natural abundance of a small place, of a valley, or a, you know, one region, one community. So we can see that fundamentally there's this idea that the human and the human person, we can embody aspects of the land, that we are an expression of the land in many ways. And of course that makes perfect sense when you think that we need the resources of the land to live. We eat the produce of the land, we drink the water, we breathe the air, we chop down the wood to make our homes and have fires. We are part of this process of the land being alive. So it kind of makes sense in spiritual terms that people would see themselves as embodiments of the land, you know, regardless of whether they're aristocrats or not. That used to be one way that we saw ourselves and how we belong to a place. Not that we own it necessarily, but that we are an expression of it. Of course, it's a very attractive idea to this day, you know, that still attracts many people. Of course, it has a problematic side to it, has a problematic side, you know, blood and soil nationalism, and the perversion of that idea can lead to a very dark type of politics. But there's also there's a more positive side to it, you know, that you love your people, you love your land, you want to share in it. So there's the dark and the light side of this myth, if you like, to this day, that people still experience, for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. I get what you're saying about both sides of it. Yeah. So you started us off with the profound statement about myth being a way to convey, you know, what we believe, why we are the way we are, and maybe there's a bit of how we should be as well in myth. So we've been talking, I think, in a good way of how this applies to our times now. But I'd like to ask you more directly, how do you see the tradition of our Celtic myth And how does that inform us for our lives today, our personal lives, and of course the wider culture?
So there's two parts to that. I think the first part is that I think it's always good and healthy for anyone to engage with history, with the roots of our culture, and to understand how we as humans have thought about ourselves in the past and how that connects to how we think about ourselves now. So I think just in terms of having a good all-round education, an appreciation of humanity, it's good to study the past. Yeah? It's good to study where we've come from, to study our roots, if you like. The second part then is what is the story, or what are the stories, what are the philosophies and concepts that arise in this this study of the past, and how do they relate to how we live today? Because we are obviously now in a very, very different situation to our ancestors in the deep past. The world has been transformed, not only by technology, but the technology of commerce and the economy and politics. Everything is just totally, totally different, even though we still live in exactly the same type of body. Our culture has utterly revolutionized the world, but we still live in the same basic type of human body. The human body hasn't evolved that much in the last 10,000, 20,000 years. You know, we still breathe, eat, walk, love, hate, have complicated relationships with each other. That reality is still very much part of our story. So even though we might think, well, they're just old stories, what do they know about how we live today? They're still talking about a basic human experience that I think we can still understand and attune to. When I'm teaching courses on Welsh myth in particular, we have a very fascinating set of stories known as the Four Branches of the Mabinogi, which are the classics of Welsh myth in many ways. And I would say that one of their uses, one of the ways we can use these stories, is as teaching tales. Yeah, they're stories that teach a particular moral perspective or a particular understanding of the world. And some of the lessons that come through the study of these teaching tales is the importance of balance between the sexes, also of different types of humility, different types of relationship to power. So if you have power and you have responsibility with that power, what should you do? You know, how should you be? How should you behave? And these stories illustrate the correct relationship to power through the positive and the negative. So there are positive stories about this is the correct way to use power, or this is the wrong way to use power. Yeah, political power in particular. I think the Four Branches of the Mabinogi, even though they're ancient myths, were also sort of reformulated or reworked as stories for the aristocracy of Wales roughly about 1,000 years ago, so that storytellers could teach moral attitudes, could teach wisdom to the nobility, how best they could be noble people, people with power. And in that sense, many of those lessons still apply to us today, I would say. They're still good advice to be had in there. Maybe not mystical, profound spiritual visions, although that's possible, I reckon, but just basic common sense wisdom, how to be in the world, basically. And I still very much believe that they apply to us today, for sure. And I think you can say the same about Irish tales, too. You know, Irish storytellers, in very much the same way, looked at storytelling as an opportunity to educate, to teach, to pass on wisdom. And that's definitely something that we see in, you know, the Second Battle of the Moytura, for example, stories concerning the Dagda and Crian Vale, the satirist, and how the Dagda interacts with this satirist who's a bit of a parasite on him. And, you know, these are very moral stories, if you like. Yeah.
Hmm.
I was about to launch off into something big and complex, but I reined myself in there. You'd be glad to hear.
Okay.
It's such a vast topic, you know.
On that, I've been in the divine time somehow in this conversation, so the time has flown for me. I got to know you, Guillaume, through, well, I found your website. I signed up for your emails, so I was getting some video updates from you. So that's one thing I'd recommend people to do, CelticSource.online. You have a YouTube channel, Celtic Source. So I'd really recommend people to jump to Guillaume's channel and subscribe and engage. But can you tell us a bit more? You mentioned your teaching. So how does this extend into this online teaching, isn't there?
So, so just very briefly, I spent a long time in university in Wales, and I ended up gaining a doctorate in pretty much what we might call the Welsh Bardic tradition, in the history of it. And through that, I studied Celtic myth quite seriously in, you know, Welsh myth and then Irish myth. And then because I have that qualification, it's just been very easy for me to start teaching online, basically. And I provide courses on Welsh and Irish myth. I'm currently teaching a course right now on stories of the Tuatha Dé Danann, on what's commonly known as the Irish mythological cycle. And I teach courses all the time. There are video courses there that you can follow at your own time, at your own pace, or you can join the live sessions. You can follow the courses either way, really. But that's all through the website, CelticSource.online. And yeah, I also just love what I do. So I often will produce more material than I can teach. So then I just put it on the YouTube channel, and it becomes like a resource that I can point people to. You know, when a student says, so what's the connection between Dano and Dawn? I can say, well, go and watch this video. And then it's, you know, so it's useful for me to have that resource there too. But, you know, I'm really happy for people to use it. I'm a firm believer in sharing in culture. I think we need to share culture for it to be alive, yeah? And I think we're very lucky these days that we have these incredible technologies that make it really is the golden age of learning. You can learn whatever you want these days, and it's all freely available, and long may it be so, I reckon. So all power to you guys at Bite Size too, you know, keep going, keep it up.
Yeah, fantastic. Yeah, on my side, I'm not qualified. I call myself a culture enthusiast. I don't teach Irish, thankfully. Others who are qualified work at Bite Size and do that. They're the fluent staff and instructor and learning content developer. So I'm just here kind of facilitating through my interest, which is kind of interesting in its own way. But hey, and I absolutely agree with you. Like somebody who's watched this whole interview with you, Guillaume, and they're thirsty for more and they want to learn more, like you're there online to learn from. So what better resource than to be able to jump into your world and jump into the resources you've created, and then your live calls, your live classes, you might call them, as well. So please, for those watching, jump to CelticSource.online to connect with Guillaume. So Guillaume, thanks so much. Gurmeen Amaga, do you have any parting words about this whole thread of myth and divine time and history that we've been talking about?
I suppose that what I really want people to take from all of this work is that, you know, cultures really come alive when you engage with them, imaginatively, linguistically, spiritually, whatever it is for you, they really come alive when you immerse yourself in them. So I suppose, you know, see this as an invitation to full immersion, not just in Irish language, but in Irish culture and Welsh language and Welsh culture, the Celtic cultures in general. Immerse yourselves in them because they're very rich and they're very rewarding.
Oh, fantastic. Our motto at Bite Size is Gaeilge gach la, Irish every day. So it's a very linguistic focus on it, but it's the idea is about taking it into your everyday life and being the language, regardless of how good or bad you are at the language. And of course, it extends further culturally, as you say. So our motto is a bit more focused, of course, on the language, but I absolutely agree with you, Gunam. So Gurumila Mahagut, thanks so much. It's been a pleasure and a privilege to speak with you today. So thanks so much.
Croeso mawr, diolch yn fawr, take care. Nice to speak to you.
Well, wasn't that a tour de force? First thing I've got to say, I love the Welsh accent. Might be from listening to all those Super Furry Animals albums when I was a teenager, but isn't it just one of the nicest accents in the world? And so much fascinating material from Gwilym there. The Indo-European shared heritage that we have in Wales and in Ireland, and of course across Europe and going over to the Middle East and as far as India, I think. So amazing to hear about those links and the possible connections. I always think it's very tantalizing. We'd love to really know the facts of how those languages came and the cultures were shared. But it's hard to be so sure. So it's theories we're dealing with a lot of the time in this material. But really, really, really fascinating. So tiolch to Gwilym there. Don't forget that you can get your 10% discount off annual or monthly membership of Bite Size Irish to engage with the language, engage with the culture meaningfully, as Gwilym said. And to do that, just go to offer.irish and you can sign up there. You'll get 10% off. So, Gurumila Mahagavas Eishtachtlin and you, thanks for listening. It was a long one today, but fascinating, I'm sure you'll agree. I'll be back again in 2 weeks. Slán lát.